Mini-episode 1936 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1936. You have with you here today two of your favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, Rick Morris and Russ Cohen. Russ Cohen, of course, also 12-time author, Sportsology proprietor, and again, about the 12-time author thing here, Russ, start by talking a little bit about the new book here before we get into this whole Leo Carlson business.
Yeah, it's just about the the greatest games in Yankee history. We had John Sterling write the foreword, the late, great John Sterling. So he gave a really good synopsis of his career. People like it. We had Billy Martin Jr. Helping us out with it. Scott Brosius. Some really good people. Sweeney Murdy, who covered the Yankees for years on WFAN. So some really good people, some really good stories. We really think people will like it.
Absolutely. Sounds like they will. And so go check out that fine book. And again, we decided to turn to you here in the month of July. There's generally not a whole lot that goes on. And for anybody that checked out recently, Pro Hockey Draftology 2026, still available on the main page of FantasyDraftHelp.com. Maybe some famous last words in there from me about, you know, the contract situations. You know, they aren't what they used to be in the month of July. You know, it's not like, you know, you got Marian Hossa coming, you know, due or anything like that back in the day when it would be this mad scramble. Lo and behold, out of nowhere, but perhaps not out of nowhere, and that's where you'll be able to fill in the background a little bit more. This whole deal with Philly dangling the offer sheet here to restricted free agent Leo Carlson from Anaheim, subsequently matched, but it will be now the biggest contract in the history of the NHL. And this is something where, again, this feels like a significant historical marker as far as the NHL goes and what happens with salaries, how they will unfold in the years to come. So talk about this, Russ, because again, you obviously cover the world of hockey very in a very broad sense, but also in a very narrow sense as far as matters with the Philadelphia Flyers here. So the extent to which the Cutter Gauthier situation, you know, from a few years back might have had something to do with this here. Spill it all out as far as what you think led up to this situation here. And obviously it was a thing where Philly thought it would be a very impactful move to make and that he would probably be in excess, you know, production-wise of the four probably late first-round picks that they would end up surrendering had they gotten them.
Right. Well, the first thing is, you know, about the picks. Like, if they expect to be a playoff team, then Anaheim's really getting, like, four picks in the 20s. So it's not as appealing as it sounds because it's like, yeah, you're getting first rounders, but you're kind of getting the lower part of the first round. So there's that. There was talk about this Leo Carlson stuff for a while. I just didn't know if it would ever happen. It happened. I didn't think it was going to happen. I mean, I'll be honest, but I also knew Anaheim was going to match. Like, you know, there was some good reporting that said that the Samueli family gave Pat Verbeek full open checkbook this summer to spend as he needed to. So there's no question they were going to match. Philly was just trying to get a 1C that they have not been able to draft or develop the same way they haven't been able to draft or develop a power play quarterback. These are things that for years they have needed. They have not been able to do it. So they thought they'd go this route. They didn't. I don't think they're going to do another offer sheet in this summer. And so now everybody's prices went up because had they not done it, I think Verbeek would have gotten him signed for about 15. Now he had to pay 18. Okay. But like the Flyers prospects that have to get paid, Jamie Drysdale, Trevor Zegras, they were rumored to be signed quickly before the offer sheet. Now it's not so quick. Why is it not so quick? Because Pavel Montukov signed for like 7.25, something like that. And he has less credentials than Jamie Drysdale. So Drysdale, who's thought to be getting 6 1/4, is probably asking for at least 7, 7 1/4 now, and so on. You know, again, Trevor Zegras, while I don't look at him as a center, the Flyers have used him at center and wing. So now a top center got $18 million. Now, of course, Zegras doesn't have the same upside, but he has upside. And so he's going to look at whatever was being offered to him and say, the prices just went up. So the Flyers were smart to put him into salary arbitration because you can't tender an offer sheet, but they didn't lock him up ahead of time. They locked up Tyson Forster ahead of time to a very reasonable deal, but they didn't get those two locked up. So now this is going to be fallout from that. Everybody's prices went up now. So, you know, if they had gotten the player, they wouldn't care. Now that they didn't get the player, I think they're going to care because, again, they're going to have less cap space than they'd hoped for. And so that's the calculated risk. It didn't go through. And I think it did change the league. We did see, like, on your neck of the woods, you know, Dylan Larkin expanded his list. And that probably helps Dylan Larkin. I don't think that pushes Steve Yzerman to do anything quickly based on his, you know, the way he had his the way he had his video session where he said, I'm only going to be brief here. And he was, and he was like, he'll trade him when he feels like trading him, when he gets the offer that he wants. So that's not going to be a rush. So will there be another offer sheet this summer? It's possible. Maybe Adam Fantilli with Columbus, maybe, or maybe Columbus comes out now in the next week and signs him, because they are now going to get defensive and other teams will get defensive so their guys don't get offer sheeted. So, yeah, it's changed the landscape. The money's always been there. Like, the cap was going to go up. The prices didn't necessarily go up a lot yet, and now they are. The owners are making their money, so the players are just – this was big for players and for agents and for those people that were kind of putting it out there that, oh, Leo Carlson's not happy with the Ducks. He dispelled that in about 10 seconds. And again, for people that were saying, well, this could cause trouble in the room because now Carlson's making more. No, everybody's price went up. Cutter Gauthier's price just went up. They're all happy. Everybody gets more money now. So this was a situation where I just saw there was a lot of interesting reporting, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, some of the reporting that I've seen, you mentioned $15 million. I've seen reporting that they could have had Carlson for $15 million, and Verbeek was like, which
we don't know that for sure. We know he balked at 10 or 12 at the beginning, and then it kind of went up. I don't know if he really could have had him at 15. We don't really know that. Okay. We also know he could have signed him before this for even less. So yeah, Verbeek made a mistake. There's no
how much did it sticks that. To him. I mean, this. I'm not necessarily going to say firing offense, but this is serious. You have effed your cap seriously by misjudging this situation here. Mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt about that.
Luckily for them, they have one of the best cap guys, if not the best cap guy in the sport. And if you notice, they started to make moves already before they matched this offer. They brought in Nick Jensen. They re-signed another defenseman. So they were kind of building up their defense while this was happening with cheaper contracts. And now listen, all the experts out there can say, hey, they're never going to be able to do it with this defense. But if we know anything about Joel Quenneville, is he could do it with less on defense. So it may still work out, Rick. It's just everybody's going to be overblown because everybody's making too much of it, in the sense that, yes, Anaheim screwed up their cap a little bit. They'll correct it. You can go over it in the summer. They'll have to make some deals. Maybe they have to use draft picks to get rid of the cap space. Whatever they have to do. They have one player I know they could put on LTIR. Whatever they have to do. In the end, they still kept the best player. And that's what you're supposed to do. So their fans are happy. And in the end, yeah, it might be a little tougher coaching job for Joel Quenneville, but I don't think it's going to weaken them as much as people are saying. I think it weakens them a little bit. But again, they have young guys that have room for growth. Mintukov is one of them. So I feel like it's probably going to level out, you know, for what they lose to this. But they did manage to maintain and keep a big-time player, a 1C, which in this league, maybe 10 teams have them, maybe 12 max.
Right.
True 1Cs.
Yes, that is true. And as far as it goes in terms of Gauthier and in terms of the alleged bad blood between the organizations that may have existed before this, in any sense that that might have influenced this in a personal direction for Philly to have targeted this specific player, what are your thoughts on that, on whether Philly perceived internally that perhaps there had been any kind of tampering with Gauthier previously? That's the rub of what people seem to be implying. Is
that people want that to be the case. I don't believe that's the case. It makes for a more salacious story if it is, but these two teams have traded a lot. Like, so it's like, I don't think that was the reason. I think the reason was they identified a player that they realized they can't draft and they haven't been able to trade for, and they went and tried to get that player. I don't think it has anything to do with the other part, because it's not like they're going to get Gauthier back. He's not going to sign with the Flyers, even if he doesn't sign with Anaheim. But Gauthier will make like 15 a year and he'll be happy. But again, this is like the new normal. So I think that part of the story, I think that's just, you know, made up.
In terms of Carlson's contract and what's been there, there was a lot of what I would call knuckle dragging commentary as far as like 67 points. Are you kidding me?
I know.
But it's one of those things also where, and I went to look in the aforementioned Pro Hockey Draftology 2026, again, available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com, jointly produced with Sportsology, of course. Going in there and looking back at my top 32 in the NHL for the next year and my top 10 for the next 10, he actually narrowly missed on both lists right now. He is only 21 years of age, and I'll give you the proviso that a year from now, he might perhaps make the cut on both of those. He didn't make the cut, and on the top 10 for the next 10 years list, he didn't even make the five honorable mention, which, again, we're talking about some really hellacious names. So it's no shine, you know, off of him whatsoever to have not been, you know, considered for lists such as that. It's not necessarily a reflection on him, but it is a sense of, and again, he's a very good two-way player, which is a little bit harder to quantify, although, you know, plus minus is probably as close as we come. But it is one of those things where, again, it's a little out of whack, it seems like, to where he is now, maybe not necessarily to where he'll be as that contract matures into the 5 years, I would say.
Right. So, you know, right now, at 67 points, he still would have been the Flyers' best center, right? So that's easy decision for them.
Sure.
But I think he'll be 75 or 80 points this year. And I think that'll be like his norm. It's hard to be a point-a-game player in this league. I think if you look around the league, there's fewer point-a-game players than ever before. It's not easy. So, and the great ones, yeah, like Kucherov, like they just go crazy and they're way over that. Sure. But there's a lot of guys that are just at that or just over that, but not a, you know, but not a great amount of them where you'd say, oh, it's easy to be a point-a-game player, because it's not. And especially on a team that makes the playoffs but doesn't go far in the playoffs, right, like the Flyers did. So I think there's that to consider. And yeah, he has speed, he has size, he needed to get stronger, he's starting to get stronger. So he is going to be a real handful. Again, what we also have to look at is, besides defense, there's faceoffs. He's a 1C, he goes up against the best competition in the league. So there's that. You have to be good enough to be doing all of that, and that's why this position pays at a premium, because it's hard to do. It's not easy to do. So he's got two more years of what I see is upward development. Now, the problem with this structure now is they could be slipping into what the NFL had problems with coming out of drafts, because their players are older than the NHL players, when before they had the slotting. And if you remember, these younger players were getting these massive contracts all in front of them. Baseball does that too. And the Anthony Romans and guys like that, you know, didn't necessarily earn it. So I look at it now and I say, we're going to test this. This is now a test, because again, if a few teams fail at paying this kind of money up front to younger players to lock them up just because it's young and it's more affordable, then that could change too. So that's a little bit of a gamble here, because the hockey player is a little younger. But you remember that in football, right? When it became a problem.
Yes, I do. And actually, the funny thing is, I was thinking baseball, but we'll make it football also. I do want to get into lessons that can be learned from salary structures and other sports and where we may be going here. I have one more question.
Anthony Romano, sorry, not Anthony. Oh, no, actually, no, Romano's the football player. I think it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. All right, I have one more question I want to ask you about Carlson.
Roman Anthony. No, I switched it. It's Roman
Anthony with the Red Sox. Yes, yes.
That's I know what you mean. That's what I was trying to say.
Yes. A very, very elite-level prospect who is coming along. You know, I would say probably pretty good.
But they paid a ton out of the gate for him.
They absolutely did. And that's you know where that originated. You know what city that practice originated in, do you not?
I don't.
That was the early 90s. That was John Hart in Cleveland. Pay the guys up front with Baerga and the guys like that, Lofton and that Bell. That was the first wave. Lock them up young. It was right when Jacobs Field was opening, et cetera. So I want to ask you about lessons we can learn from baseball and football as far as where hockey may be going in this regard. One more question about Carlson specifically and his ceiling, because I would postulate that in the course of the 5 years, you mentioned point a game. I would postulate, and this is a much more rare kind of thing than that, but I think you got to be a triple-digit scorer to merit a contract like this. I think you got to be over a hundy. Would you agree with me on that? And B, do you think he has that as his potential ceiling?
No, I can't say he's going to have 100 unless Cutter Goche is scoring 60 goals like he's turning into Austin Matthews. Okay. I just think that's a tall one. Like, that's okay. McDavid, that's Kucherov. Again, that's not what we're talking about here. And I think the only reason I don't agree with you is simply because, like, this is what the salary is now.
Okay.
Now, McDavid, I think, was making, 13?
Yeah.
But that was a while ago. So this is just, you know, the prices are going up. Just, you know.
Yeah.
To use a term that nobody else wants to really hear, but it's true. It's an affordability issue.
Sure. Yeah. Just like society writ large right now. But, what's McDavid going to make when he's out there? Like Celebrini, like now that the precedent has been set, somebody is going to do this with Celebrini if San Jose doesn't preemptively give him, like, I don't know what the preemptive number would be, 22, 23 million a year. Like, what do you do to keep him off the market? So this is where, like, the really, really elite players, the really elite players are going to be like the Scott Boras players in baseball, like Tarek Skubal, who they must hit free agency. Yeah. Like, that's what it's going to be.
But I want to point this out, like, as an example. So Elias Pettersson, when he had 102 points in 22-23, mm-hmm. he was 24 years old. Where's he now? He's terrible at the moment, right? So I'll take a guy that's going to get 75 to 85 every year over the guy that gets 100 a few times and then drops off the face. And I think that's what you have to worry about a little bit when you say that.
Well, I mean, but here's the thing. You look at a guy that's 5 years older than him that's become a triple-digit scorer, Nick Suzuki. Is it not realistic to expect that he would become, you know, Nick Suzuki in the next 5 years if he's going to make this kind of money?
I think it depends on his team. I think Suzuki's a tremendous player. But I think also the team he's on.
Yeah, surrounded by a lot.
Mm-hmm. He's surrounded by a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I think if that happens, then it could happen. Okay. But it's hard to predict that. That's my issue. But let's see. There's 800 point guys in the league. I mean, that's not a lot.
Right. But so I mean,
basically what I'm saying is I understand he has the highest salary. That's today. Mm-hmm. When Matthews gets his salary, it'll be higher. When McDavid gets his salary, it'll be higher. When Celebrini gets his salary, it's higher. That's three guys right there that could score 100 every year. So if there's eight guys, maybe nine every year, it's going to be hard to say Carlson's going to be one of them religiously. He might do it 1 year like Pettersson did, but you get what I'm saying.
Well, and let me ask you the question that I was going to ask you vis-a-vis baseball in terms of we are going towards a situation at the end of this season and just did a podcast on it recently here that, again, this is the last season of this CBA and that I'm not going to necessarily say that there is going to be some kind of floor and cap in the new system, but The owners are more unified than they've really ever been. The large market owners are on board with doing something different. And I think the players may come to see that when you have these welfare teams like my tribe here in Cleveland and Pittsburgh and in Miami, and these teams have just put the money in their pockets.
Colorado.
I think the players are sick of that. You have to force the cheapskates to spend. And I think some type of thing is going to work out in there. And I think the players realize, and here's where my question gets to hockey. It's the middle class baseball players that are getting screwed. This is a system that's beautiful for the high end. If you're Ohtani, if you're getting the contract that is equivalent to in the NHL, that's going to be either Celebrini or McDavid or both of them that gets like that sets the market the way that Ohtani did. And nobody's going to make more than that. But still, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of million for these players here. But it's not really trickling down to the middle class. And you wonder if you talked about that before, as far as some type of thing like what the NFL did, what they put into place so that those rookie contracts at the very least wouldn't overshadow what established players are making. If the NHL doesn't move towards something like this, you wonder if it might not be a middle class squeeze also, because the rich are always going to get their money. Like, teams will chase the players.
Oh, yeah, the good players always get their money.
Yes, but what happens to everybody else? So that's what might make the hockey union, which is always, you know, pretty tough, you know, at least these days, might make them amenable to doing something along those lines to kind of smooth it out, because otherwise the middle class players could end up getting screwed if such a disproportionate amount goes to the high end players like you've seen in baseball the last couple decades.
Yeah, I would say this. I think the way it's going to work out is, like we said, top players get their money. Never a question. I think top nine players, first line, second line, third line, top four defensemen, they're all going to be fine. I think it's when you're talking about fourth liners, third pairing guys, they're going to struggle. Unless you're elite at that and you can make top of the market for that type of player, which is never close to top of the market for like a McDavid, then you're going to struggle. You're going to go from team to team to team. You're going to get 1 year deal. Sometimes you'll get two if you're on a cup contender, but those guys will struggle. And some third line players might struggle, but not centers. So I think there'll be some weeding out of that. And I do think with baseball, there will be a floor. They may not call it a cap. They'll come out with some sort of fancy, whatever, but there's going to be a minimum for sure. I would be completely shocked if that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I would agree also too. I mean, I have a stronger sense that there might be something different coming out of this year's whole thing, and it might have required
it's
some
be a work
on
stoppage. The it just depends on how long.
Well, and that's the whole thing too. Is that, and this is what people really kind of overlook, is that it's a thing where at the end of the day, I think the owners, even more so than the players, the owners haven't had the stomach for it. They want the system to change. It's one of those things like everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. So right. It's a thing where you have to endure the short-term pain, and the owners have not been willing to do that. And I, in a recent segment here on the show, I actually look back to when Seth Everett was on the show, I think in the late 2010s, and he was like, it's going to be different next time. It has to be. It's going to be different. The owners are going to stand up to him. They folded the same as they normally do. I think they missed like a little bit of like spring training time, and everybody watched their crap. And then it was like, oh, okay. Yeah, well,
the only thing where I won't say Seth was wrong at was, I don't know if anybody envisioned how low some of these bottom feeders, how little they were going to spend on payroll. Because now even the Cardinals aren't spending money.
Yeah. First of all, I could have told you that being in Cleveland. I could have told you how low they were going to go. For St. Louis, I will say in their defense, now it doesn't look like it because they're kind of punching above their weight, but they're in a rebuilding situation. It doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money at the beginning of a rebuild. So
but
I kind of get
making
that.
A lot of money, Rick, but okay.
They are. No. They are. And that's the whole thing too. And that's what I'm glad you're bringing that up. Because that's the whole thing. Like, I have to say that to my dad. I'm like, these players making all this money. I'm like, who do you think should be? You think Jimmy Haslam should be making more money? Like, right. Who do you think it should be going towards? I'm glad you brought that up, because nobody ever talks about how much the owners make. But that's a thing where, again, you wonder, you know, with the hockey thing here, because this is going to set such a precedent. And this is one of these things where, again, and I go back to this recent segment that we did, you know, in baseball, and talking about the work stoppage coming up at the end of the year, and that these CBA expirations that have happened over the years stand somewhat as sort of benchmarks. I would say also the collusion scandal of the late 80s, certainly the beginning of free agency, 74 to 76. That was the thing that turned the tide. Like, the owners used to be dictators, and then once the reserve clause was thrown out, now the players have sort of become the dictators, yeah. And we've never really had equilibrium. So it's a thing where I look at it in the case of hockey. Hockey has the pendulum swings both ways over a period of time, but it's a thing where I look at I think it really took the establishment of the WHA back, especially in the 70s, for the salaries to start to go up. Guys,
yeah, because NHLers, the guys left the NHL for it. It was a big deal.
Yes, you had that, and then the pendulum swinging the other way with what was it? I think it was the 2005 CBA where they put the first salary cap in.
Yes.
So you had that. So it's like, are we going to look at this as the start of a significant chapter in the history of the sport? Because I kind of do. I kind of think this.
No, it is. It's changing. It's changing because, like some other sports that are struggling in attendance, baseball, I'm looking at you. Mm-hmm. The NHL is not.
Yeah.
And so for as long as that's happening, and as long as their TV contract is good and the cap keeps going up, they're in a prosperity mode right now, especially mm-hmm. the players. Players are giddy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where, again, I kind of think that as well. I mean, it's easy for people to brand you as being a prisoner of the moment to say that this is a historical kind of development that's happened. But no, I agree with you. I think it really, really is, because I think, again, it'll never be the same as far as, like, Celebrini in particular. Like, he probably wouldn't have gotten an offer sheet from anybody. I'm not sure that Connor Bedard would have gotten an offer sheet from anybody.
Bedard could have, but now that he blew out his shoulder, he's not.
Yeah. Still don't know how that's going to go. But that's like with an asterisk on it, because if it was just on the pure talent right now, he would be getting offer sheets. Probably. Now it's a thing of, like, now that he's got the question mark, you know, that's not necessarily the case. But, yeah, I mean, it opens the door for all of these top prospects here at the end of their first deal to end up having that happen. And that's where there really is.
Yeah, if you don't lock them up, you're risking it.
Yes, you are. And it's going to be one of those things where, again, everybody is going to have to learn the lessons of Pat Verbeek on this, the lesson he learned the hard way, which is, again, players have options. And one of the things, too, and I want to circle back to something from earlier on that was said, I think that this is – you made a very, very excellent and very underrated point, because the media has been talking about – this hasn't happened primarily over a period of time because, you know, gentlemen's agreements. That makes it sound like we're only a hop, skip, and a jump from the baseball collusion scandal. But,
right.
You know, like, you don't mess with my guys, and I won't mess with your guys. But what you're talking about right now with Philly sitting here like, well, now what? And having to kind of make adjustments here. That's a part of this as well, and that is almost certainly it might be maybe 50% gentleman's agreement or whatever percentage, but the other part would be, well, what do we do if we don't get the guy? Clearly, that's something right. They had to be thinking about, because you see how it is with Philly right now.
Yeah, I think it's 20%. You don't mess with mine, I don't mess with yours, because, you know, teams okay. have strong relationships. But I think that's pretty much done, because, again, 2 years ago, Philly had all this cap space planned for this offseason. And if you looked at the list was robust.
Mm-hmm.
But a year ago, the list became less robust when the cap started going up, and even less robust as we inch towards free agency now. So that's when a team like Philly and other teams are looking at it and saying, how the hell are we supposed to get better?
Yeah.
Like, there's no free agents out there. Everybody's retaining their guys. So yeah. They're looking for other things that are within the CBA to do it.
Yeah. And again, it was a strong move on their part. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And again, this was something
But it's a double-edged sword. Like, and that's the thing. I'm fair about it. Mm-hmm. I don't kill Briere for doing it. Mm-hmm. I just say you could have even been more prepared than you were, because now, you know, you're going to cost yourself a little bit. It's good that they try. Don't get me wrong. It is. Yeah. But now they have to have a new strategy. That's all.
Is there a point at which they could have forced Anaheim to blink at like 20, 22, whatever? Is there a point
They could have done 20.
Okay.
And they could have even had more front-loaded money, because mm-hmm. then it would be a little higher because the pay is higher. Would that have done it? Maybe. Would they have wanted to pay it? No. And I think that's the part that we're leaving out here. It's easy for us to say, hey, just they should have made it 20 or 22.
Right.
Yeah, except they don't want to pay that for the guy. Yeah. They had a number that they stopped that too for a good reason. And remember, Comcast, the corporation, like, hey, they have a lot of upfront money that they can give and pay these bonuses upfront and not blink, except there's a limit to what they want to do too. Everybody has a limit, Rick.
Right. Well, and I'm going to bring it all full circle here by asking you, because again, it's hilarious that there are some wuss athletes out there like Deshaun Watson and Andre Rison. I think Cleveland is a tough sports town. Like, please,
ooh,
you think we're
Cleveland.
A tough? You think we're a tough? It's cream puff with the media here compared to places like, well, Philadelphia. So
I'd have to say that's true.
Yes. And so what I'm wondering is he comes there, he gets this contract in a universe where Anaheim doesn't match. What do you think the odds are he ends up getting heat like $18 million for this production? This guy's barely a point a game. What do you think the odds are that that would have happened?
I think that would take a little while to erode. But if he became like just a 60-point guy, it would happen.
Oh, they'd be throwing rotten vegetables at him if he was a 60-point-a-game guy. Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine if that happened. Oh, that would be ugly. That would be worse than Ben Simmons level if that happened.
I don't know if it would be Ben Simmons bad. That's a real mark.
Well, you know, it would be pretty bad anyways. But
yeah. Maybe, you know, Kwame Brown, Ben Simmons, those are special cases.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. But something that is always very special is the chance to have any conversations on the show with you, Russ Cohen. So, again, great work, as always, at Sportsology with the 12 books on the market. Go check out the new one on the Yankees. Look up his author profile at Amazon. It's all right there. Russ, thanks so much for coming down to break down your you've got kind of a ringside seat here to the Leo Carlson stuff here, covering Philly. Yep. As much as you do, as well as the wider hockey world. So your insights very, very much appreciated, as always, my man. Thank you so
Anytime,
much.
Anytime, Rick.
Appreciate it, bud. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1936.